We start today's program with the U.S. Supreme Court dealing another blow to legal limits on campaign contributions. In a 5-4 ruling today, Justice Anthony Kennedy joined with the court's conservatives to strike down the aggregate limits on campaign contributions. In English, that's the cap on how much total money you can donate to candidates and committees during a 2-year campaign cycle. While caps on individual donation amounts are still in place, the move will allow donors to give overall to more candidates and causes. Sam Wyszynski, Executive Director of the Arizona Advocacy Network, joins me now. Sam, good morning.
Good morning, Steve.
Sam, I think your reaction is probably fairly predictable, but let us know what it is.
Well, we're really concerned that this furthers a warped concept that money equals free speech. The five justices continue to undermine American democracy, which really was established for the many, not the money.
And you think, is this a consistent pattern that we're seeing? How nervous are you as we go forward, and what could turn the tide the other way?
Well, it is a consistent pattern with this group of justices first defining corporations as people and money as free speech. We saw how they ruled against Arizona voters who passed an anti-corruption and civic engagement law, popularly known as Clean Elections in Arizona, undermining that anti-corruption law that was passed in 1998. We've seen how they've undermined voting rights, and we need to really look at this money and politics issue along with voting rights and how that's going to impact negatively America's democracy.
How negatively do you think it'll affect America's democracy in November? We're just a few months away from another big election.
Well, in Arizona, Republican lawmakers passed against voters' wishes a bill last year that already swept away these aggregate limits. So we've already seen, for example, even with the SRP board election that's coming up, an increase in the size of contributions that individuals and corporations, quite frankly, are making to candidates. In the past, you saw an election like the SRP board election very low on as far as the money being spent. It's having a dramatic impact, and it's not just going to be on congressional races or legislative and statewide races. This is going to impact school board elections, the 12 rural counties that elect judges. It's going to have a significant impact on America's democracy and how policy is made across the country and in Arizona.
Sam, do you see this favoring clearly one party over another, or is it going to be both huge parties taking advantage?
Actually, it favors millionaires and billionaires over working voters. And again, this truly is a concern where we've seen this ramped up battle of wealthy individuals and corporations versus working voters, and who's going to control who's being elected and who actually is being represented in our elected bodies.
Sam, finally, does this have to start at the grassroots level then for folks who vote on a regular basis, maybe those folks who don't even vote, having to get seriously involved and making their voices heard more?
Yeah, Arizona Advocacy Network and a lot of our partners through the Arizona Wins and One Arizona coalitions are out doing a lot of education to voters. And voters here in Arizona particularly have caught on to the fact that money is playing a bigger role in our elections than their vote. And they're upset about it, and they're ready to take measures in their own hands through a citizens' initiative process in the future to regain control of policymaking here in the state.
Sam Wyszynski is Executive Director of the Arizona Advocacy Network. Sam, thanks for the time today.
Thank you for reporting on this important issue, Steve.
It's KJZZ's Here and Now. I'm Steve Goldstein in Phoenix. And now we're joined by political consultant Sean Noble from Washington, D.C. He used to work for Arizona Congressman John Shadegg and then became more well-known after ProPublica reported on his efforts on behalf of the Koch brothers. Recently, Mr. Noble has started a new organization called American Encore. Sean, thanks for being with us.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Sean, we'll talk
about... Sorry, I couldn't be there in studio. I had to hop on a plane to come back here yesterday, so I apologize for that.
Back on Capitol Hill. All right, Sean, before we talk about American Encore, obviously a huge Supreme Court ruling, probably not far from where you're sitting right now. What's your reaction to the 5-4 decision today?
Well, I completely agree with Justice Roberts in the decision, talking about there's no more important component of free speech than political speech. That's the most important component of the First Amendment, because it's the component the Founding Fathers ultimately understood was critical to the continuation of individual individuals having the ability to voice their opinion, because what they wanted to do when they set up, in the ratification of the First Amendment, was to say that government should not be able to do things that stifle people voicing their disagreement with government. And so that is what political speech is. It's talking about, you know, engaging in efforts to make sure that elected officials and candidates understand where people are coming from.
Sean Sambrzynski.
So I think it was a great decision.
Well, as Sam Brzezinski just mentioned, he's concerned about this idea of millionaires and billionaires getting even more power and influence. Why shouldn't we be worried about that?
Well, it's interesting that, millionaires and billionaires don't have any more influence than the typical voter when it comes to the voting. I mean, everyone has a vote, right? Voters have the ability to cut through the clutter and understand what the messaging is. The disagreement I'd have with Sam is that he would say, we'd want to take the influence of millionaires and billionaires out of it because we think that they're over-influencing elections when they're really not, because what they're doing is that they're contributing to political speech, and the important component of political speech is what is the message, what's being said, and it is typical, unfortunately, for many of my liberal colleagues to say, hey, we need to know who's behind the speech. We need to know who's funding the speech, because that's important. The only reason that they want to do that is because they want to change the subject, in my mind. Conservatives, I believe, have a stronger argument about the vision of America and what needs to happen in this great nation. And so the way that liberals can try to overcome that is try to change the subject on who's doing the speaking, not what the actual substance of the argument is.
But Sam, what about the argument that millionaires and billionaires might be directly impacted and perhaps benefit more than the average person? You're right, there is one vote for each person. But, for example, a lot of people who don't have $10 million to spend won't have that same influence on potentially thousands of other voters.
Yeah, and I agree with that. The challenge is that, legislators who pass public policy. I mean, it is. I would be very interested to hear the argument of all the conservative wealthy individuals who engaged in the political speech in 2012. Certainly, that did not pay dividends when Obama got reelected. So, this isn't just because you spend a lot of money, you're gonna benefit from it. I mean, Harry Reid has been on the Senate floor saying the only reason that people do this is so they can get even more rich. Well, that's not true. I think the thing that drives individuals, and this is true, Sam, a lot of folks like Sam would say, well, we worry about corporations. The funny thing is that corporations really don't play in this kind of space as much as people might think. This is really individuals more than anyone. And these are individuals who care about the country. They care about, they have been blessed with success. They want to provide that for their kids and grandkids. They want to retain what they think is a wonderful free enterprise system. And does that help them? Maybe, maybe not. But what it does is it secures a future for their children and grandchildren.
True, Sean, but I think just one more quick thing about this, and going back to what Sam said, I think there are progressives, obviously, in this country who've done extremely well, too. So, and they want a certain influence in one direction as well. So, again, I guess I come back to not conservative versus liberal, but perhaps, and I don't want to get accused of doing class warfare here, but this idea of those who have benefited a little more and those who aren't quite there yet or are striving for it but have not reached that high level of financial acumen.
Well, and I think that what you'll see is that what's interesting about the argument is that the folks like Tom Steyer on the left and folks who like Sheldon Adelson on the right, they fund organizations and like Sam's and other organizations like the other organizations that I run, which are really mobilizing individuals who are, in fact, those normal people. And so it really is not wealthy individuals trying to increase their influence. It's wealthy individuals using their contributions to try to engage people of like mind. And most of the people who become activists in the political scene, whether it's on the right or the left, are not wealthy. They are hardworking people who have a commitment to their belief system. And so organizations like mine and organizations like Sam respectively try to mobilize people on either side of the spectrum to engage in this process.
Sean, a couple more questions before you go. One is why did you get into politics? Was it to serve the public or was it to benefit yourself ultimately? Because I would think,
well,
that's...
Politics is not a place to benefit yourself,
okay,
in my mind. It all stems back to, as a kid, my parents were very engaged in teaching me about the importance of what we had in this great land, that America was, in fact, exceptional. It was a place that was special. And I was truly a Reagan baby in the sense that I grew up in Sholo, Arizona. My mom sat me down. I was 10 years old in 1980, and she said, call these people and tell them to vote for Ronald Reagan. And it was all the Republicans in Navajo County. It took me like 20 minutes because there aren't very many Republicans at that time. I called Democrats, and I got a sense of what it was to talk about politics as a young kid, and I just got the bug. And really, it's been driven by my philosophy that I want to protect what the Founding Fathers were able to put together and protect the God-given rights that we were given, because I think this really is a great nation, and I want to do everything I can to continue to make it great.
And, Sean, where does American Encore fit into that?
So American Encore's mission is to do exactly that, to try to encourage people to recognize that America is great again. This is something that stems from when I was working for Congressman John Shattuck as his chief of staff. I would go and talk to high school students at AP government classes. First time I went, I asked the question, who here believes that the United States is the greatest nation on earth? And less than half the hands went up. And that shocked me as a kid who, grew up, watching the USA beat the Soviets in hockey in 1980, watching Reagan get elected, being, completely steeped in the patriotism and the greatness of America. I was absolutely flabbergasted. And that same thing repeated itself every time I went and spoke at a high school. And I realized that there's something missing. Reagan in 1989 at his farewell address from the Oval Office said, we've had this resurgence of patriotism and pride in our country, but we need to institutionalize it. We've lost that. And here 11 years later in 2000, when I asked this question for the first time, I saw what he meant. And so the purpose is to help people understand this is a great nation. It needs to be a shining city on a hill to the rest of the world. It needs to be able to demonstrate that freedom does matter.
Sean, finally, very quickly, how do we quantify patriotism? Because I think a lot of people listening right now would say, well, we can still think America's great, but it should be greater. Is that not being patriotic?
Well, I absolutely believe America should be greater. I mean, that's the very essence of what we're trying to do is, but to understand that America is unique. I mean, I think that sometimes people take pride in saying, well, I don't think that America is the greatest because I'm not going to be, judgmental, or I'm not going to be elitist about that. That's not what I'm talking about. I'm talking about understanding that we provide a system of government that is better than any system in the world. It was something that we need to protect, that we need to go back to the founding principles of what the freedoms really are there for. We were given these freedoms by God. They're to be protected by the government and held by the people, and that's something that's different than most of the rest of the world, and we need to embrace that and understand that that's what makes this a great country. That's what makes our economy thrive, our free enterprise system, and it's ultimately what's going to raise everyone's standard of living and help everyone become a success.
Political consultant Sean Noble joining us from Washington, D.C. His new organization is called American Encore. Sean, thanks.
Thank you for having me.
Still to come on Here and Now, we'll talk about the controversial life of Charles Keating, who's died at the age of 90. Stay tuned.
KJZZ is supported by Morrison Vein Institute, helping patients step back into their active lives free from painful vein problems. Treatment from a medical and cosmetic perspective. Veins are all they do. MorrisonVein.com.
This is Here and Now on KJZZ. BBC NewsHour starts at 1 this afternoon. Checking conditions around the state right now, it's mostly sunny and 39 degrees in Flagstaff, partly sunny and 49 in Prescott. Casa Grande reporting 61 degrees under sunny skies. It's sunny and 62 in Tucson, cloudy and 63 in Yuma. Is your car always in for repairs? Is it ready to kick the bucket any day? When it's time to get a new car to get you where you need to go, donate your old ride to the programs you love on KJZZ. We'll send you a tax receipt and we'll tow it away for free. It's easy. Go to cars.kjzz.org. Partly sunny skies and 64 degrees right now in Phoenix. It's 11:22.
It's KJZZ's Here and Now. I'm Steve Goldstein. Charles Keating was a banker and developer who was responsible for the Phoenician Resort on Camelback Road. Federal officials also determined he was responsible for losing hundreds of millions of dollars in investor and customer money when he made risky decisions regarding Lincoln's savings in the 1980s. His name also became synonymous with a group of five senators who allegedly tried to intervene with regulators on his behalf. Two of those senators were Arizonans, John McCain and Dennis DeConcini. Joining me for a few minutes to talk about Charles Keating is attorney Michael Manning, partner in the law firm of Stinson, Leonard, and Street. Michael, thanks for joining us today.
Good morning.
Michael, what comes to mind for you when you think about Charles Keating?
Well, it was an astonishing era in our country's history, in our state's history. Charlie was really a brilliant and charismatic man, and had he stayed straight or played by the rules that we all had to play by, he would have been one of the most wealthy business people in our state and beyond. So it's I feel sad for his family. He was I'm afraid to, and I'm sorry to say, he was as crooked, as his reputation, but he didn't have to be that way.
So he intentionally acted to hurt investors and customers and knew exactly what he was doing.
Well, he did. One of the things that he and his folks did is he sold junk bonds to retirees in Southern California, claiming they were safer than government-backed bonds. Knowing that they weren't, and he raised hundreds of millions of dollars that way, and many, many families had their fortunes completely taken away.
So he was a complicated person. I know we use this with a lot of well-known, infamous folks. You know, I mentioned giving the $1 million to Mother Teresa. He was a devout Catholic. How do you reconcile a person having this many angles to him?
Well, I don't think that's terribly unusual, is it, for some personalities that have done such notable and ferocious wrongs. The $1 million he gave to Mother Teresa, those weren't from Keating; those were from the public. He raised money by overlending dollars to friends of his. If the person wanted $30 million for a development in Tucson, he would say, I'm not going to give you that. I'm going to give you $32 million, but I'm going to ask you to contribute that extra $2 million to my candidates and to some of my charities. This was essentially public money. So, you know, he is a complicated man, but there's more to that story.
Have regulations been put into effect in the years since that would make something like this more difficult to happen?
Absolutely. Charlie was brilliant taking advantage of the brand new deregulation of savings and loans in the mid-80s. And he took that as a license to make extraordinarily silly and risky investments with taxpayer dollars. And at the time, there were regulations which would have prevented it, but he managed to keep those investments and some of his decisions secret. When we first took over Lincoln Savings, we discovered wholesale forgeries, backdating of documents. They were very, very good and clever at hiding what they were doing. So even the regulators who were careful at the time really didn't discover what was going on until it was actually too late.
Michael, finally, how long will the Keating Five label be remembered? Is that one that will always stick to John McCain and Dennis DeConcini until they're gone?
Well, I hope so. I shouldn't say I hope so. I don't think that's a label that should stick with them any longer. They were fooled, like many people were fooled, and should they have been more careful, perhaps. But I think that Keating Five label will stick longer than frankly it should.
Attorney Michael Manning, partner in the law firm of Stinson, Leonard, Street, talking about Charles Keating. Mike, thanks.
You bet.
This is KJZZ's Here and Now. I'm Steve Goldstein. Salt River Project is a nonprofit subdivision of the state of Arizona. And if you live in the valley and Arizona Public Service doesn't provide your electricity, then SRP does. The SRP board is powerful in its way, but hasn't attracted much attention or money until its latest election this week, which included one candidate who spent $20,000 of his own money. With me to provide details on the SRP board's election is Ryan Rendazzo of the Arizona Republic. You can follow Ryan on Twitter at Utility Reporter. Ryan, good morning.
Morning. Thanks for having me.
Ryan, we were just talking earlier this hour about millions of dollars being spent on elections. So thousands may not seem like much, but explain why it was a lot when it came to the SRP board elections.
Well, it's a lot of money because most of these candidates never spend more than $500, and they're usually winning their seats on that board with a few hundred people voting for them out of the entire metro area.
So how was the money spent? What were they spending it on?
Well, they spent it on mailers to remind people that they need to ask for a ballot if they want to participate in this election. And there were a handful of billboards around the Central Phoenix area. Excuse me, not billboards, but the smaller placards you see along the roadway for a couple of the candidates. And I believe they spent some money calling people and reminding them that they can ask for their ballot. And then, oddly, you have to remind people to mail it back in because a lot of people think they're going to participate in these elections and then sort of forget about it come election day.
Who gets to vote for the SRP board? And if everyone who is eligible voted, how many total votes would there be?
Well, there's about 600,000 people who own property in the territory and are eligible to vote. And the election, this one, I believe, set a record because it got more than 2,600 people actually voting. So a tiny fraction of the property owners. One of the problems is, reason that people don't participate is it's an acreage-based system. And so you get one vote per acre you own. And if you're like the typical homeowner, you own a fraction of an acre, and your spouse is probably on the title, so you get a fraction of a vote.
Okay. Why do people want to be on the SRP board? Where does that influence come from?
Well, people have different reasons. I don't want to speak for all 14 board members and president and vice president, but the board certainly makes some powerful decisions. They have a $2.8 billion budget, so that's about a third of the state budget. They control power plants in a few different states, New Mexico, Colorado, Arizona. They decide how much to charge you for the electricity that you use at your house, and they decide what to charge the cities for the raw water that they deliver to them that serves several million people.
Ryan, you also reported earlier this week that there was some contribution coming from folks at APS, which might puzzle people a little bit, considering those are both utilities that people get electricity from. Why would APS want to... I don't want to use the term influence, that might sound negative, but why would they want to be involved in that election?
Well, that's a great question, and APS didn't really provide an answer. The APS and SRP work together on quite a few things. So they negotiate power lines where one utility doesn't need the entire line, so they build it together and share the costs. And they share in power plants together. And then, of course, they both set utility rates separately here. So it raised a lot of eyebrows that one utility wanted to have some sort of influence over who ran the other utility, its competitor, in the region.
So are the results in, considering voting was supposed to stop yesterday, do we know who won and did the folks who spent the most money win?
No. The people that spent tens of thousands of dollars did not beat the incumbents that sit on the SRP board. So John Holbert, who unsuccessfully ran for Congress in Arizona in 2010, lost a race to a financial advisor from Central Phoenix. Holbert spent about $19,000 of his own money, and his opponent spent about $1,300. And then the president of the Home Builders Association raised about $12,000, and she lost to a retiree who spent less than $500 on his campaign.
So, Ryan, if you were, and I know you're not paid enough for this, if you were a campaign consultant, what advice would you give the next time people try to spend money on this kind of race?
Well, realize that you've got your work cut out for you because it's a difficult election to win. It doesn't coincide with any other elections, so you have to reach out and tell people, one, that they're eligible to vote because the vast majority of people that own property in this area don't know that they can vote in these elections. You have to remind them to request their ballot, and then you have to remind them to mail it in. And in the meantime, you've got to convince them that you're the right candidate. you could end up convincing people to vote, and they choose to vote for your opponent. So it's a big hill to climb, and outspending your opponent 15-1 or 20-1 doesn't guarantee you're going to win the seat.
Ryan, finally, looking ahead, how might this affect future SRP elections? We've talked with you in the past about Corporation Commission, another group that really not enough people pay attention to based on their influence. So what should we expect maybe the next time the SRP board has an election?
Well, it'll be interesting. They do have elections every 2 years, and you just had two people spend noteworthy amounts of money and lose. So you might think that would have a chilling effect, and that people who have considered running for a seat on the board might realize it's pretty difficult, and you could spend a lot of money and not get anywhere. Or it could have the opposite effect, and we could see people come in and spend even more money, and that has the effect of bringing more people, more voters in. So despite not winning their respective elections, the money spent this time around did bring more voters to the polls for SRP. So maybe these will get a little bit more attention.
Ryan Randazzo is a reporter for the Arizona Republic, and if you're on Twitter, follow him at Utility Reporter. Ryan, thanks as always.
Have a great day.
It's KJZZ's Here and Now. I'm Steve Goldstein in Phoenix. Dog bites, dog attacks have been in the news a lot lately. Statewide, the Arizona Department of Health Services says there is a 139% increase in the number of severe dog bite injuries from 2008 to 2012. Maricopa County's figures don't show such a precipitous climb, but whether it's a four-year-old boy attacked by the family pit bull or a couple being seriously injured trying to break up a fight between its dogs, how serious is the issue of dog bites? In a few minutes, I'll talk with an ASU professor who studies canine behavior, but first I'm joined by Melissa Gable, Public Information Officer for Maricopa County Animal Care and Control, and Samantha Spinelli, who is in charge of Animal Care and Control's Alternative Placement Department. Welcome to you both. Thanks for being here.
Thanks for having us.
Melissa, let's start with the numbers. As I said, Maricopa County's numbers had not jumped like Arizona's numbers?
You know, not really. We average about 5,000 dog bite reports every year. And again, that's an average. Now, the Department of Health study went through 2012. And I will say that in fiscal year 2012, that was our highest number of dog bites reported. We have 5,090. But then in fiscal year 13, we dropped down to 4,878. And then our current numbers are actually showing we're about 150 fewer dog bites reported than the same period the previous year. So we are seeing a little bit of a decline.
Based on any trends we may look for, is there anything folks at Animal Care Control are thinking about, they're looking at a little bit more closely, maybe where bites are taking place or what time of year, that kind of thing?
Yeah, you know, we always check to see what areas where we have dogs running at large. Where are our bites coming in? Is that an area where perhaps we need to send more animal control officers out to make sure that animals are kept indoors and, out of the street, but also educating people about the importance of keeping your animals inside or in their yard, and also educating your family about how to interact with animals.
Samantha, I mentioned what your title was, but give us a better idea of what it is that you do with Animal Care and Control.
I send animals out to other rescue organizations and our foster homes, as well as our two adoption centers.
So what are you finding when, and I don't know if there probably isn't some sort of universal answer to this, but when we find that the dogs who have bitten someone, and there are different, obviously many different layers of that, it may just be a nip, I suppose, or maybe a dog is aggressive in certain situations. How do you work with that as far as getting dogs to a rescue organization or getting folks who want to get involved with that? Are there certain things you have to take into account, certain things you have to measure with what a dog has done and how a dog may behave in the future?
Absolutely. I mean, severity of bite is a factor. So there's some things that you just aren't safe to work with. But a lot of it is looking at circumstances. Does it seem to be a pattern of behavior, or was it a situational bite? You know, were we pulling the dog out of a canal and again does he do this all the time?
How often does that happen? Are there certain examples you can cite where one happens more frequently than others? Are you more likely to...
I can't cite numbers, but I can, just from experience and I guess just from my personal experience, situational is far more common.
Interesting. Okay. Any consistency we see with owners when it's not a case of a dog that's been deserted or a stray dog? Are people, again, is it different as well as far as how people behave and how people treat their animals?
I think so. I think there's a disconnect with expectations and what's appropriate to expect of the species, dogs. And looking from the animal's perspective, there's a lot of times we expect them to meet our needs and to meet our, you know, certain obligations to us, mm-hmm. when really what we need to be doing is going, you know, this is an animal. He has the intellect of about a toddler, give or take. I need to look at the world from his perspective and see what's going on so I can meet his needs and accommodate him if possible.
And Melissa, what have you run into as far as that goes?
I mean, I definitely agree with Sam. And the one thing that I do want to point out, too, is I think a lot of people, with all the publicity that's been surrounding these dog bites, I think it's important to let the public know that just because a dog bites and it ends up at our shelter doesn't necessarily mean it's going to be euthanized. And again, it goes back to that case by case, take the situation, consider, you know, what happened, how did this happen? And again, as Sam said, is it a pattern of behavior? Was it a one-time thing? And so I think it's really important to let people know that just because he bites doesn't mean he's automatically euthanized. Now, we do, we're very transparent with potential adopters. We let them know up front this dog was involved in a bite. We have a waiver that they sign so that everyone is aware of what has happened. But, just because a dog has bitten, we're not going to hold that against the dog because, again, we don't know the circumstances surrounding that bite.
Well, and how long, Sam, when you're involved with these dogs, how long do you observe them to see whether it is a pattern of behavior and see whether it was just one particular bad situation? As you mentioned, the way dogs are being the equivalent to a toddler, they're going to behave in a certain way that maybe is not how we always want, as those of us who own dogs know.
Yes. Well, it depends. It really is case by case. A lot of times it's taking information of what was the situation that occurred, and then seeing what we see in the kennels, in our shelters, and, of course, in our foster homes. And that can be different, too. So there's, it's not as simple as it.
Yeah, one of the things that comes up, too, and I don't want to paint with a broad brush here, so I want to see if the two of you can enlighten us a little bit. Is there a certain breed? Are there certain breeds? I know that there are no breed is exclusive as far as biting, but should we be concerned about certain breeds? They're a little bit more aggressive.
I guess yes. I mean, there are breeds that are more prone to working with using their mouths, like herding breeds. It's not unusual to hear of some nipping ankle or little kids the rear ends, you know, and getting it because they're herding them down the hallway or something. They're doing what they were bred to do. You know, it's one of those things. I know pit bulls get in the limelight a lot, but actually pit bulls were bred for, yes, I mean, it's not unusual for there to be animal aggression with pit bulls, but people aggression shouldn't be there. That's not appropriate to the breed.
I think it's also important to note that Chihuahuas, Dachshunds, Terriers, those little dogs bite too. You don't hear about it as much in the news because when they do bite, they don't do the damage that a pit bull or an Akita or a larger dog could do. And so that tends to bring the attention to them because the damage is much more severe than if my Chihuahua were to bite me.
Melissa Gable and Samantha Spinelli will stick with us through this break. And we'll be joined by an ASU professor who has an expertise in canine behavior. Stay tuned. It's KJZZ's Here and Now. Good morning. I'm Steve Goldstein. For more about dog behavior and how human behavior can play a role, I'm joined by Clive Wynn, professor in ASU's psychology department. He's also in charge of the Canine Science Collaboratory. Dr. Wynn, good morning.
Hi, Steve. Good to be with you.
This is a tough question, I suppose, but what should our expectations be as far as our relationships with our dogs, with our pets?
Well, I mean, clearly people can have, many people do have an absolutely wonderful relationship with their dogs. Dogs have been with humans for probably 15,000 years now, and they've got pretty good at figuring out what we want from them and providing us with a happy, peaceful life alongside them. There are supposed to be over 80 million dogs in the United States today living as pets, so it's a quite amazingly successful relationship. And although, you know, I know your program today was prompted by some very unpleasant incidents here in the Phoenix area, the remarkable thing is that, you know, these millions of dogs living alongside us, and actually, generally speaking, they cause very little harm, very little bother. They're really happy to live with us. But I don't think we should lose sight of the fact that each individual dog, each individual dog pup has to learn how to do that. And if we don't give dogs opportunities to learn what it is we expect from them, then things can go awry, as we've seen recently.
So how important is training, what we label as training, and to what extent does that training need to be consistent? I don't mean consistent among one owner and one dog, but across the spectrum of even different dogs, because dogs, much like humans, have, yeah, they behave a little bit differently. Of course, they have different personalities.
Yeah. Well, when I say that dogs need to learn how to live with us, I mean, sure, training, taking your dog to classes is a good idea, but it's not essential to teach your dog a whole load of clever things. Your dog just needs to understand that you're in charge and that you're not going to harm him or her, that you're going to provide safety and security, and that the dog can be relaxed and happy around the people in the home. The problems arise with dogs that don't spend enough time with people, the dogs that are tied up outdoors all day, that literally get to the end of their tether, you know, if they're tied up, and they're very stressed by having other individuals, dogs and people go past all the time, and they don't feel like they control the situation that they're in. Dogs are social beings, you know. Dogs need to be with people, and it's tough on them to be tied up or locked up for long periods of time on their own.
Right. Some of us would wonder why people would do that in the first place.
Well, the thing is that
to be judgmental for a second, sure.
Sorry?
To be judgmental for a second, yeah.
Yeah, well, I mean, the thing is, we all want the pleasures of dog companionship. I say we all. I mean, many people want the pleasures of dog companionship, and it's a wonderful thing. But one needs to think seriously about what kind of life one needs. And I'm very fortunate. You know, I am able to work at home quite a lot, and so I can provide my dog with company through large chunks of many days. But we all of us get into situations where we just can't be at home as much as we would like to be, and the poor dog is left alone, and that's tough. These are very, very social beings. I mean, even more so, we humans are social beings, but dogs maybe even more so. They really do suffer when they're left alone.
And Dr. Wynn, would a so-called happy dog bite someone or attack someone?
I'm not a great expert on dog attacks. I wouldn't want to go out on a limb there as to exactly what are the causative features that lead to dog attacks. But I think, generally speaking, a well balanced dog in a happy home is of course much less likely to cause a problem than a dog in a difficult situation. One of the studies that looked at what causes dogs to bite found that actually it's not just a function of the dog, it's a function of the people around the dog. And often dogs that bite belong to people that bite as well, as it were.
You know, we're seeing more people, Dr. Wynn, who, to exaggerate a bit, treat their dogs almost as kids, or they spoil them or treat them in a different sort of way. How might that affect, as we go forward, how might that affect the behavior of dogs? Again, I don't want to lump it all in together, but is there a feeling that as we start to treat the dog as more than just a loved companion, that could develop other complications?
Well, you know, treating dogs as beloved companions, as family members, it may be more widespread today than it was 100 years ago, but it's been a part of the human-dog relationship for as long as we have records that help us to understand what the human-dog relationship was like. So there are ancient Egyptian burials of dogs with inscriptions that make very clear that the people 5,000 years ago loved their dogs. And there are books written by ancient Greeks from 2,500 years ago that make very clear that affection was very strong, very deep. So I don't think we need to be embarrassed about feeling affection for our dogs. And I don't think, although it's possible that it's more widespread today than it was in history, it's not a new thing. It's not a new thing. And to some degree, if I'm going to let this animal live in the most intimate spaces in my life, I mean, why not have affection for it? I don't think it's entirely crazy to have affection. I think it would be crazier to have an animal live inside your home and not feel any fellow feeling for that animal. That would actually be crazier. But that said, one has to keep in mind that this is not a human being, that to some degree we can respond to our dogs the way we respond to our children, and a lot of the time life goes along happily, but the dog actually has different needs than a child does, and I don't think many people get too confused by that, but you know, when people start feeding their dog slices of cake from the table, that is just not, who knows whether it's appropriate for our digestive systems, but certainly eating cake is very unhealthy for dogs. Eating chocolate is very unhealthy for dogs. And there comes some point where we have to recognize that this is a different being, a member of a different species, and its needs need to be respected at that level.
Dr. Clive Wynn is a professor in ASU's psychology department, also the director of the Canine Science Collaboratory. We were also joined by Samantha Spinelli of Maricopa County Animal Care and Control and Melissa Gable, who's the PIO for Animal Care and Control. Thank you all for the conversation.
Thank you.
Thank you.
You're listening to KJZZ's Here and Now. I'm Steve Goldstein. 2 years ago, as Arizona marked a century of statehood, there were a lot of lists related to 100 of this or that. So what can be done to acknowledge or celebrate 102 years? Photographer Lisa Olson has teamed up with Terry Peisel for an exhibit of practical art called Century Club. It features 102 photos of Arizona. The photos have been transferred onto wood panels. Olson says they tried to cover the entire state.
It's definitely a bit of everything. There's kind of like this almost a snapshotty concept. I mean, there's definitely all areas of the state. Terry's actually from Flagstaff, so there's quite a few pieces from Flagstaff. There's some all the way down to Tucson, a lot of Phoenix in between. The two of us actually took a road trip together and kind of visited a lot of northern Arizona. So there's some Cottonwood, Jerome, Sedona, just all those great little unique spaces, spots around Arizona that just make it so unique. Lots of desert landscapes, some of sort of Phoenix and the overall buildings, and there's really something for everyone.
Has there been a feeling that your appreciation for what Arizona has, whether it's the natural resources or other things, has grown as you've gotten older?
Definitely. Especially, I mean, I'm a photographer. I went to ASU. I got a degree in photography. And, you know, I've traveled a lot, and everywhere I go, I find myself just looking at it different than I look at Arizona, because Arizona's home. So that was also kind of something that both Terry and I wanted to work with in terms of this show, was just sort of taking a moment to appreciate what's around us and what Arizona does have to offer, and how it in actuality is really not that different than any of those places. Like, you can find beauty in everything, and there's tons of it here in Arizona.
Okay, we're talking about 102
yes.
photos for 102 years. I mean, I'm guessing you guys were not choosing from like 104. I mean, there were...
No.
So, I mean, can you give us an idea of what went into deciding what you really wanted into it?
A little bit of everything. I mean, Terry and I definitely tried to sort of edit each other and sort of help make it sort of seem cohesive. Like, we both have different styles of shooting and different styles of photography. So, I mean, like, I helped edit some of his work and he helped edit some of mine, so that it just sort of like melded together. It definitely was not just 104 photos. There was probably somewhere around like 1,000 in actuality that we kind of like both looked at and narrowed down. So that in itself was quite a task. But a lot of it was just making sure that it felt like it was a complete piece and a complete overview of Arizona, not just like, hey, I like Phoenix, so it's all Phoenix, and hey, I'm from Flagstaff, so it's all Flagstaff, but just sort of like more of a exploration of everything.
What is it about, other than growing up here, what is it about taking photographs here that you love?
There's one photo in particular that I took of actually kind of just the sign at the downtown Phoenix Public Market. And I, you know, Practical Art, we have a booth there most Saturdays. So it's like just this really great community space that I'm passionate about. I love it. I enjoy being there. But so it's like this photo that just sort of represents like that community, that space, and just that sort of building and what it kind of brings to the community. So I think that's definitely a key when you get into more urban spaces, is sort of recognizing the people or recognizing the spaces that bring everybody together and make it so unique.
I want to come back a little bit to the, whether it was 1,000 photos or whether you were exaggerating slightly. Maybe you weren't.
No, I really am not.
Okay.
I'm an overshooter.
Okay.
Anyone that knows me will totally vouch for that.
Okay. So we come down to 102.
Mm-hmm.
Are we talking about in the group of 1,000, are we saying like your 102 maybe favorite shots from those 1,000, or
Are we saying in the midst of that 1,000, were there maybe like six of one site and you guys picked the best one of those six, or were there like many, many places you just didn't get a chance to use?
A lot of it with me is that there's six or 100 of one place, okay. And then you have to narrow it down to the ones that you like. And there's definitely a few places where there's more than one image from it. But yeah, it's definitely, I'm a firm believer in, especially with digital photography, like overshoot everything, because one angle you might like it better. It might bring out something different that you weren't even aware of. So for me, it's more of like, hey, I went to this place and I took these 300 photos and now I'm going to narrow it down to like two that I really like. So there's definitely a level of just editing it down to the best of a situation.
Are there certain things that ended up surprising you? Like there was a shot that you really had wanted to get, maybe you didn't get exactly what you wanted, but what turned out even better than you'd hoped?
There was definitely, I've never done the photo transfers before. It's a process actually that Terry has worked on for 5 or 6 years and is really great at it. It's a very unique, it makes them very amazing. So this was the first time that I had tried the photo transfer process. And it is definitely interesting to see how that affects an image. Because an image that I might've liked super just by itself plain, I'll still like it once it's transferred, but then the one that I wasn't really sure about and I liked it, but it was like, whatever, now is like my favorite. Like just that transfer process and the randomness of it and the lack of precision to parts of it. Like, you get an air bubble in there and then that creates like a little almost vintage kind of feel to it that it wasn't there before. And so it just makes them super unique and super individualized in a way that was very new to me and very exciting.
Lisa Olson, thanks so much.
You're welcome.
Photographer Lisa Olson. Her Century Club exhibit featuring black and white and color images of Arizona will be at Practical Art near Central and Camelback through the end of April. You're listening to KJZZ's Here and Now. I'm Steve Goldstein. It's a busy night for sports in the Valley as both the Suns and Diamondbacks have home games in downtown Phoenix. But a match with more of an international flavor is taking place this evening at the University of Phoenix Stadium in Glendale. The U.S. hosts Mexico in soccer in the American team's final match before their World Cup training camp. Here to tell us more about what we should know about tonight's contest is John Arnold, editor at Goal USA. You can follow him on Twitter at Arnold, John. John, good morning. Thanks for being with us.
Pleasure. Thanks for having me.
John, how big a rivalry is this, and will that be reflected in tonight's crowd?
It's certainly the biggest rivalry in the region. North America, Central America, and the Caribbean are all grouped together by FIFA, the governing body of soccer. So it's definitely the biggest match here, and it's one of the biggest matches on the international stages. Now, there's not as much at stake in tonight's match because it is a friendly, an exhibition match. So there won't be as much, maybe, intensity as there is in other matches, but it'll still definitely be an intense match, and certainly the fans will be out for both sides on this game.
And briefly, give us an idea of the rules again, because there aren't going to be the real top stars playing tonight, right?
That's right. There's certain dates where clubs have to release their players to national teams, but this was not one of them. So essentially, the players will be from Major League Soccer, which is the league here in the United States, and Liga MX, which is the Mexican league, because those are the leagues that are essentially willing to let these teams have their players. The big superstars, some of them are here and play in Major League Soccer, so guys like Michael Bradley, Landon Donovan, Clint Dempsey for the United States will be there in Glendale tonight. But some of the European-based players who play for the, in the English Premier League or in the Spain's La Liga, they won't be there tonight because they're still playing with their club teams.
Now, one person who's gotten some attention is Julian Green. What should we know about him?
Yeah, he's an 18-year-old player, and he's really kind of a mystery. He could have represented Germany or the United States because he's born in the U.S. and has a German mother. So he chose to represent the United States. On the international level, he's only 18, but there's a chance that he could get onto that World Cup squad in Brazil, which would be a huge feat. I mean, it's a huge feat at any age, but to be an 18-year-old kid, just a teenager, and making a push to do this would be huge. This will be the first time he's suited up to the United States. It would be the first time he enters the game if Jurgen Klinsmann, the manager, does decide to play him. So that's something that soccer fans in this country are very excited about, is to see him for the first time.
John, how closely are you watching what the outcome's going to be, what the score is, or how much is this just about seeing a good match and kind of getting guys ready for World Cup tryouts?
The individual performances are probably more important than the actual result. Now, with that said, because These are very competitive players, and the rivalry does exist. They definitely want to win this match. But, you know, if the United States wins or if Mexico wins, it's not really an indication on either of those countries' chances to, you know, do well at the tournament in the summer, which is, you know, the showpiece event only happens every 4 years. So that's really what they're preparing for. A win tonight, you know, would be a big boost for either of these teams. But at the end of the day, honestly, they're not going to be too concerned with the result. It's really about what each individual is able to do and you know, how that looks as a squad playing together. You know, you got to build that cohesion. So that's another big thing. And so the result isn't as important, but, you know, they'll still be going for a win for sure.
John, last question, pretty quick answer. Is the Valley a good market for top-level soccer?
It's a great place. They wanted to have this game here in Phoenix specifically because of the mix of fans of Mexico, fans of the United States. I think it's a great market and definitely somewhere that places are trying to build on.
John Arnold is editor at Goal USA. He's on Twitter at Arnold, John. John, thanks for the time.
I appreciate it. Thank you.
That's all for today's edition of KJZZ's Here and Now. Thanks to Nick Blumberg and Sarah Ventry for their help, and thank you for listening. If you missed a segment or want to hear a past edition of the program, go to KJZZ.org later this afternoon or download the KJZZ app to your smartphone. Now it's time for NPR's Here and Now on listener-supported KJZZ FM Phoenix and HD. I'm Steve Goldstein. Have a great day. It is 12 noon.
KJZZ is supported by Mesa Arts Center. Hugh Laurie, star of TV's House, performs live with the Copper Bottom Band for a night of gritty blues, June 3rd. Hugh Laurie tickets on sale.